Please turn in your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 30. In case any of you think me to be cowardly, I'm still going to go back to chapter 28 with Saul and the witch or medium at Endor sooner or later. But right now we're continuing in the story of David, really shortly before he is to be made king. I have really just loved getting to go through 1 Samuel. You know when you start, there are great stories like David and Goliath. There's going to be all kinds of neat stuff there. But what really has made me marvel is a chapter like this, which in my lifetime I've probably read 30 or more times, and yet to study it and to see Christ in this chapter and to see the application, it is a gold mine of truth. And this is actually one of my favorite passages where so much wonderful is here. I also learned this week it's the last text, contains the last text that Spurgeon preached in his church in the Metropolitan Tabernacle in London. I can't promise I will preach like Spurgeon, and I hope this will not be my last sermon, but just the same, that was interesting to me. The context, if you'll remember, is that Saul is king in Israel, but he has failed, and God has determined to remove him, and the Lord has anointed David to replace him. Saul is jealous, and he's been chasing David, trying to kill David. The Lord has protected him. And finally, last time in chapter 27 and 29, we saw that David was tired of being chased, so he went over to the Philistines, the enemies of Israel, and is among them, kind of as an exile. And the Philistine leader likes David, this Achish guy in Gath. David gets his own little town outside of Gath. I gave the example kind of like if Achish is in Escondido is Gath, well then Ramona or something like that might be where David is in Ziklag. But David faced a huge problem in chapter 29, and that is that Achish and the Philistines are about to go off to battle against Saul and the Israelites, and they expect David as their guy to come with them and fight. And the Lord delivered David miraculously, in that the other leaders of the Philistines didn't trust David. They sent David back to Ziklag, the city where he and his people were. Now, while all this is going on, Saul is getting ready to fight. Saul has his encounter, we will see later in chapter 28. And what the Lord is doing here, it's the final stage of what really Hannah sung her psalm about in chapter 2. Remember way back there? It was about the Lord raising up some and lowering others. And Saul, the proud and the mighty one, is being brought down. And David, the one whom God has chosen, is being lifted up. And in this text, the Lord is speaking to us. He's speaking to us as David is so much in this chapter like Christ as our King who wins the victory for us and shares the spoils of victory with his people. And also, David is not just like Christ, David's also like us. Spurgeon wrote that each of us may find something like himself in the long, eventful, and checkered life of David, the son of Jesse. He said, "I almost rejoice that it was not a faultless life, for its errors and failings are instructive." I read about David, and I see myself and how God is merciful to you, to me, when we fall short as David does. So, again, remember the scene. David and his men, if you can picture this, by the way, they've marched with the Philistines 60 miles from Ziklag to Aphek, where they're getting ready to fight the Israelites. Then, right after they get there, they're sent right back another 60 miles, kind of tiring, a few days each way. And as they're coming home, no doubt they're tired. It'd be nice to see the wife, the kids, have a home-cooked meal. Look what awaits them beginning in verse 1. "Then it happened, when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag, and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. And they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went their way. When David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep. Now David's two wives had been taken captive, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him. For all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. You see, what happened is David had his 600 men, and as they marched off with the Philistines, originally to battle against Israel, the city was left unprotected. All you had left was the women and the children and the livestock. And while they were away, perhaps the Amalekites, who were a desert tribe, these were enemies of Israel from long ago. Actually, in the days of Moses, they had fought Israel. God had pronounced judgment against them. God had actually told Saul back in chapter 15 of 1 Samuel to judge them and to wipe them out. And Saul had failed to do that. But these guys, when David is gone, they come in. They burn the city to the ground. But they don't kill the inhabitants. They take them captive. Now, you might read that and you think, well, boy, these guys are fighting according to the Geneva Convention or something. They, you know, David, when he took the cities back in chapter 29, he'd kill everybody. These guys, these Amalekites must be nicer than David. Well, it wasn't because of the milk of human kindness flowing from these people. It was actually, as one person said, they wanted to have a tent sale. They wanted to take all these captives and sell the women and the children as slaves, probably. But we know in the providence of God that God kept them from harming the women and the children. Now, when David and his men get there, they see their cities burned to the ground, but they notice there are no bodies. They figure out what's going on. And they weep. And it's a remarkable statement. These men who are so exhausted from 120 miles of travel in several days, it says they wept until there was no strength left in them to weep. And these were manly men. But there's nothing unmanly about sorrow. Jesus wept, shortest verse in the New Testament. And nothing moves us emotionally like concern for our families. And David's men were not only sad, they got angry. In verse 6, it says that the people spoke of stoning him because all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and daughters. And so, you know, it's interesting, these men who had followed David, when David refused to kill Saul, they kept following. When David led them into the land of the Philistines, they kept following him. When David marched them 120 miles in several days on a wild goose chase, they followed him. Now they've had it. And they're talking of killing him. They're so upset. You know, and perhaps with some cause. Why didn't David at least leave 100 men behind to protect the city? He left the city unguarded. And we read in verse 6 that David was greatly distressed. And this may be, for all the trials that David goes through in the second part of 1 Samuel, the greatest low point that he experiences, about as bad as you can get. You can picture this guy. The city's smoldering. The families are gone. The Amalekites may have a weak head start on him. And his men want to kill him. That's about as bad as it can get. Well, why did this happen to David? Well, if my interpretation of chapters 27 and 29 are correct, that David had no business going among the Philistines, and he didn't listen to the Lord, this is the consequence of his foolish decision. And it's interesting, because back in chapter 27, you remember it said that David said to himself, "Now I will surely perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than to escape to the land of the Philistines." He was wise in his own eyes. He trusted in himself instead of leaning on the Lord. It seemed to work out initially in verse 4 of chapter 27. Saul left him alone. He gets his own town. Things seem to be going well. But in the end, it's big trouble. But at the end of verse 6, we have one of the sweetest phrases in the entire book of 1 Samuel. In this, all this trouble, even trouble I think of his own making, it says, "But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God." And what I think is going on here is really restoration. In chapter 27, he leaned on his own understanding. Now he's turning back to the Lord from what I think was a backslidden state. Now, remember in chapters 27 and 29, David never made mention of the Lord. He never sought guidance from the Lord. He got into this mess. Now he cries out to God. He seeks wisdom from God. We'll see in the next section. And God delivers him. And this is part of what shows David to be an ideal king for Israel. Not that he's perfect. He's a man like us. But even when he's wrong, he has the grace to turn to God and seek mercy and help. And when he's deeply distressed, when Saul's deeply distressed in 28, he goes to a witch to get mystical guidance. David turns to the Lord. And verses 7 to 10, he seeks guidance from the Lord. David inquired, verse 7, "Then David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, 'Please bring me the ephod.' So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. David inquired of the Lord, saying, 'Shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them?' And he said to him, 'Pursue, for you will surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue all.' So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those left behind remained. But David pursued, he and the 400 men, for 200 who were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor remained behind." So David now seeks directions from God. And this actually is part of the contrast between him and Saul also. Why is Abiathar and why is the ephod with David? Well, it's because several chapters ago, Saul got mad at the priests and he killed off all the priests but one, who escaped with the ephod to David. So that's the blessing of God on David. The ephod was a means that God had through the priest of communicating his will to the people. They would inquire of the Lord, and there were stones. We're not sure, you know, if one of them lit up or something. You'd get answers from God. And the Lord gave direction that he reveals to David that David should pursue the Amalekites and that he will rescue the captives. In contrast, in chapter 28, heaven is silent before Saul because of Saul's sin, and he seeks guidance wickedly. Now, even though the Lord has promised deliverance, there's also an instructive point here. When the Lord said, "Okay, you will rescue them," it says, then David and his men, having already gone 120 miles, what do they have to do? And by the way, whatever energy they didn't expend rushing back and forth 120 miles, said they had wept till they had no more strength to weep. Now what do they have to do but pack up and go again and chase these Amalekites out into the wilderness? And the point being, although the Lord had determined to deliver the people, it required effort on the part of David. The Lord didn't send a group of angels to go bring the people back. The Lord didn't just say, "Just wait and fire will rain from heaven on the Amalekites and your people will be there waiting for you." David and his men had to strain themselves to exhaustion, even to the point that a third of them, 200 men, are too tired to keep going. As Spurgeon makes the statement, "God won't help David without David doing his best." Now, some of you might think that sounds a bit suspect, but it's actually biblical. God works through means. God does it, but he uses means, and the means are going to be David and his men marching and fighting. Some application from this first part of the passage. First is that when you sin, you may discover that your sin has consequences. When David went to the Philistines, when he didn't seek God, trouble came. And if you become a Christian, when you're in prison, they don't let you out. If you've done drugs and abused your body with drugs and alcohol, it doesn't mean that the effects of that are going to all go away. If you've been foolish with your money and gotten into awful debt, your troubles aren't just going to go away. If you marry an unbeliever, you may have a hard life being married to an unbeliever. So sin has consequence. And the consequences aren't always immediately. Sometimes it seems to be okay. For example, if a man fails to pay his income taxes several years ago, and all of a sudden he's nominated to be a cabinet official, his sin of the past may come back to haunt him, or he may have no consequence. But another point here is that others may be affected by your sin. David was not the only one hurt by this. His men, his family, they were harmed as well. And we need to realize, especially those of us who are leaders in the church, in a home, in a business, that when we sin, I counsel a lot of situations where a man or a woman has been unfaithful in a marriage. And it's not just him or her that's hurt. It's the spouse, it's the children, it's the friends, it's the family. It ripples a long way that our sins have consequences, and many can be hurt by our sin. We also see here that the Lord may use trials in his loving discipline to bring us, to drive us back to Himself. That the Lord disciplines those whom He loves. The psalmist says, it was good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your ways. And for David, this is the affliction seems to be what drove him back to the Lord after what I think was a period of backsliding that lasted over a year. Spurgeon said, the worst days I've ever had have turned out to be my best days. When God seemed most cruel to me, He has been most kind. So God may use your troubles to make you realize you can't run your life very well on your own. You need His grace. The most wonderful part of this part of the section to me, though, is that this is a demonstration of the mercy and the kindness of God to sinners. That there's good news for backsliders. David is like us, and each one of us at times in our lives have backslidden. We've slipped into sin. We've perhaps become dull in our spiritual life. We've quit reading the Bible. We've been lax in serving the Lord. We've perhaps indulged an area of sin, maybe privately. And here David, he'd sinned against the Lord by not seeking the Lord, and he made some bad choices. But God had mercy upon him. And this is wonderful news, that even if you're in trouble of your own making, even if due to your own sin you're in a mess, and you may be tempted to say, well, God's done with me. I don't deserve His mercy. I just need to suffer because that's what I deserve. This is chastisement upon me that I needed. That David is a demonstration that even if you're in a mess of your own making, even if you've backslidden, even if you've turned your back on God, if you turn back to Him, He will receive you and He will show kindness and mercy to you. This is great and wonderful news. He invites His backslidden children to return to Him who delights in mercy. When in trouble, when distressed, do what David did. Strengthen yourself in the Lord. You know, the city is burned. The smoke is still rising. His family is gone. The men want to kill him. And we face times in our lives. You've lost your job. You're having trouble in your family. Someone you loved has been diagnosed with cancer. Maybe you're the one who's facing that. Your loved one has been taken from you by a sudden death. And you feel alone and you feel tempted to despair and to despond. You can do what David did. In this lowest moment, he strengthened himself in the Lord his God. In the Psalms, there are many places where he does this. In Psalm 25, to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. To you, my God, in you I trust. Do not let me be ashamed. Do not let my enemies exult over me. Indeed, none of those who wait for you will be ashamed. Those who deal treacherously without cause will be ashamed. Later on in the psalm, in verse 16, turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. The troubles of my heart are enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses. Look upon my afflictions and my trouble, and forgive all my sins. Look upon my enemies, for they are many, and they hate me with violent hatred. Guard my soul and deliver me. Do not let me be ashamed, for I take refuge in you. We could be tempted to give in to despair. We could be tempted just to look at the smoldering city and the angry men like David was in that situation and just want to give up or want to beat ourselves up more and you're worthless. There's no hope for you. And you need, as we've said before, you need to talk to yourself. You need to remind yourself of the character and the mercy of God, that His mercy is greater than your sin, that His grace is sufficient for you. He's promised if you will turn to Him that He will receive you and help you and embrace you. And even if it's all your fault, don't let your unworthiness keep you from coming to Him. He wants you to admit your unworthiness and to seek Him. And one of the hymns we sing sometimes says that don't let your lack of fitness keep you from coming. What He requires is that you admit your need of Him. That's all He requires. He says, if you tarry till you're better, you'll never come. He wants you to come as you are, and He will receive you. We also see here that David seeks guidance from the Lord when in trouble. He stops trusting in his own understanding. And how we don't have an ephod. We don't have Abiathar, the high priest. But we have a high priest in heaven who intercedes for us, to whom we can go at any time. we have access to the holiest place through prayer. And we have not just a word or two from an ephod and Abiathar. We have the whole Bible by which God guides us and gives us His understanding as we seek Him there. We have promises and we have revelation that guides us in such a wonderful way. And one more application before we move on, and that is that God accomplishes His purposes. He accomplishes His work by means of our effort. In Philippians 2, 12 and 13, Paul says, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work in you both to will and to work according to His good pleasure." Now, it doesn't say work for your salvation. Jesus already worked for your salvation. It says work it out. My analogy would be when you get married, and if I'm performing a marriage, I might say as you're leaving, "Now go work out your marriage with fear and trembling." You're married now. That's done. But now that you're married, it requires effort to make this work. And as God has saved you and you've entered into this salvation, now you need to live it out. And to grow in grace, to grow as a Christian, to fight sin, is not some passive experience where God just kind of zaps you and you're holy, or God just kind of zaps and makes things happen. It just as David and the men, they couldn't sit there in Ziklag and start trying to rebuild their tents or something, just thinking, "Well, God said He'd save them, so we'll wait for God to bring them here." They had to go fight the Amalekites and bring the people back. One application of this is in evangelism. God has surely determined to save His people, hasn't He? To save the sheep for whom Christ died. But He uses us in doing that. And one thing which we deplore is what has been labeled hyper-Calvinism. Hyper-Calvinism says, look, if God's going to rescue people, He's going to do it and He doesn't need us. Well, if David were a hyper-Calvinist, he would have said, well, if God's going to rescue the women and the children and the animals, then we don't need to leave Ziklag. He'll just take care of it. No, God rescues the lost by the means of the effort of His people. When Paul was in Corinth and he was discouraged and the Lord appeared to him in a dream and says, stay here, for I have many people in this city. That Paul's evangelism was the means by which those whom the Lord had chosen to save were going to be saved. God uses means. And He uses the means of our witness to our friends and our family as a means of saving those who are captives to sin. So the Lord speaks to David, guides David as David turns to Him. Next, the Lord gives David a great victory, continuing in verse 11. Now they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him bread, and he ate, and they provided him water to drink. They gave him a piece of fig cake and two clusters of raisins, and he ate. Then his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. David said to him, "To whom do you belong, and whose are you, and where are you from?" And he said, "I am a young man of Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite. My master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago. We made a raid on the Negev of the Kerethites, on that which belongs to Judah, and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." Then David said to him, "Will you bring me down to this band?" And he said, "Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring you down to this band." Now, this is about the Lord giving further guidance by another means. It wasn't an Urim and a Thummim, God providentially. You know, these guys didn't have satellite imagery to find out where the Amalekites were. They didn't have a GPS. God left a starving Egyptian who was abandoned by the Amalekites. He was sick. They're in a hurry because they want to get away from David. And this guy is too sick to keep up with everybody else, so they leave him there to die. David finds him. And this guy, what we know now is that the best thing that ever happened to this guy was getting sick. Because if he had been well, he'd have died with the rest of the Amalekites, and he would deserve to die because he participated in the burning of Ziklag and all the things they did. But the Lord left him there to tell David where he could go to find the enemy, part of God's plan. So continuing, verse 16, when he had brought him down, behold, they were spread over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. David slaughtered them from the twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives. But nothing of theirs was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that they had taken for themselves. David brought it all back. So David had captured all the sheep and the cattle, which the people drove ahead of the other livestock, and they said, "This is David's spoil." So David, by God's grace, catches up to the Amalekites, and when he finds them, they're unprepared. There's a famous story in the Texas Revolution, in which in April 21st, 1836, General Sam Houston with his men snuck up on General Santa Anna from the other side at San Jacinto, another Texan who knows Texas history. And Santa Anna was overconfident. He had defeated the Texans at the Alamo. He defeated the Texans at Goliad. They were kind of partying before they would go in for the final kill and win the war. Houston, with his much smaller group of men, caught Santa Anna and his army by surprise. They marched in shouting, "Remember the Alamo, remember Goliad," and in 18 minutes wiped out the Mexican force, killing 630, taking over 700 as prisoners. 9 Texans died. In the aftermath, Santa Anna tried to hide among the men, tried to dress like a private among the prisoners of war. But every time he would pass by, the men would salute, "El Presidente!" So that plus his silk underwear gave him away. That's really true. And he negotiated freedom for Texas, which tragically they gave up when they joined the Union 9 years later. But that's another story. Anyway, David and his men, 400 men. It says there are 400 Amalekites who escaped on camels. There are probably many times that they fought, they killed, and it's a great slaughter. And this is a just war, because we saw back in chapter 15, also in Exodus and elsewhere in the Pentateuch, these people were wicked. They were under the judgment of God, and David is acting on the Lord's behalf. And it's also interesting that if you keep reading in the Old Testament, there's not much more going to be said about the Amalekites after this day. God gives David a great victory. Furthermore, everything is recovered. The women, the children, the animals, plus, remember that the Egyptian had said in verse 14, they not only went to Ziklag, but they went in other places and raided there as well. So they get back not only their own stuff, they get back the spoils from all the other raids that the Amalekites had been participating in. And now, I think this is funny in verse 20. Remember the guys that wanted to kill him back in verse 6? This is David's spoil. What a great leader David is. He's our champion. Pretty fickle, people are. So in verses 21 to 31, we have how David, again displaying himself to be the wise and godly king, shares the spoil of victory. Verses 21 to 25, he shares the spoils among his men. Verse 21, when David came to the 200 men who were too exhausted to follow David, who had also been left at the brook Besor, and they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him, then David approached the people and greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless men among those who went with David said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except to each man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart." Then David said, "You must not do so, brothers. With what the Lord has given us, who has kept us and delivered into our hand the band that came against us. And who will listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so his share will be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike." And so it has been from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. Here we have yet one more test of David's leadership. The 400 stronger guys who had gone ahead, leaving the 200 relatively weak guys back behind. Some of them said, "Look, we're the ones who fought. We should be the ones who get to share all the spoils of victory. And these other guys, they didn't help. Why should they get anything?" And, you know, we can read that now and say, "Well, that's terrible." But we can be that way too, can't we? We often think in terms of justice. Those who work more should get more. Those who work less should get less. Why should we give people what they didn't deserve? Now, what's wrong with them is very simple. They forgot who helped them. They think they won. They think by their own strength and their power that they beat the Amalekites and they got their families back. They take credit for what God has done. They also ignore the fact that the 200 probably did have some place in the victory that God gave them. David answers them very wisely. What I like, first of all, is how he begins to talk to them. I mean, you might expect David as a leader might be pretty stern with them, right? You knuckleheads, you arrogant bad guys, what are you thinking? The word the Bible uses of them is actually sons of Belial, describing not what David says of them, but what the editor says about them, the author says about them. But David says, brothers, you should not do this. Very gently. And then he reminds them of what Moses had said, that it's the Lord who gives you power to give wealth, to make wealth. He says, don't you remember that this is the victory the Lord gave us? The Lord is the one who told us to go. The Lord is the one who gave us the direction to find them. God gave us the strength to march these many miles. God gave us victory over a far superior force. God had them unready and vulnerable when we came, and God protected our families and our property. Therefore, we will all share. Those who stayed behind, those who went, it's God's victory, and He established that as a precedent. In verses 26 to 31, David does some more sharing. Now, when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, behold, a gift for you from the spoil of the enemy to the Lord. And in verses 27 to 31, it tells all the different places that David sent some of the spoils of the battle, including in verse 31, the most important place, to those who were in Hebron, and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to go. Hebron is important because that's going to be David's first capital in 2 Samuel when he's made king in Judah. Also, what we're being told here was, as David and his men were accustomed to going here, apparently when David was in Ziklag for that over a year's period of time and he was raiding these other tribes and taking the spoil from them, David was sharing it already with those tribes in Judah. He was also sometimes going among them. And this is wise. While some might think David has gone over to the Philistines, David, being a clever man, is showing his own people that no, he's on their side. His loyalty is with the people of Judah. And soon, when Saul's going to be dead, they're going to know where David's heart is. So this is all in preparation. Now, the last chapter of 1 Samuel is going to be the death of Saul. And in 2 Samuel, David is going to ascend to the throne. But for today, application. In this last section, there's some beautiful applications here. One is just seeing the men of David and how we can be in a bad way like them. How they've won this big victory and they're proud of what they've done and they think they deserve the benefits of what they've done. And we can be guilty of that as well, can't we? It's a real temptation to be proud. Proud of what we've accomplished. Proud of our education, our skills, could be our appearance, the fact that we use better grammar than other people, all kinds of different things people can be proud of. I'll tell you a true story. One night in IBCD, when I'm counseling here on a Monday night, a couple comes in. As I'm going out to the waiting room, I am shocked to see that the wife has a black eye. And I remember feeling my blood get a little warmer, thinking that I'm looking forward to talking to the husband. So they get into my office, and I said, well, what happened? And he said, well, we were having a fight, and I threw my cell phone at her, and it hit her in the eye. And she said, but that was, I think that was right after I tried to run him down with a car and fractured his leg. So we started going through the scriptures in terms of how they needed to repent of their own anger and sin and vengefulness. And I was trying to point them to the gospel and the mercy that God has shown us in Christ as they profess to be Christians. And they came back several weeks later after a few appointments, and I hadn't seen them for a couple weeks. And they came back and said, we are so proud of ourselves. We are doing so well. We feel so much better about ourselves. I went, ah, said, no. Be careful if you think you stand, lest you fall. Don't take pride in what you've accomplished. It's only by the grace of God. What do you have that you did not receive? And I gave a personal example I'll share with you as well, that I have had a lifetime battle with being overweight. And in that battle, I have failed far more times than I have succeeded. For that matter, I mean, people write, I've lost weight recently. And there could be a temptation to say, well, to be proud of oneself, to look down on other people who aren't successful. But what I remember is literally hundreds of failures where I've tried to do this and I've not succeeded. And the only reason the only reason there's been any change at all is God and His grace has helped me where I've failed hundreds of times before over a period of many years. That just reveals to me what a weak, unworthy sinner I am. And I'm terrified of becoming proud of this because I deserve more failure. And when we have been blessed, when we have accomplished something academically, personally, your spiritual life is doing better, God is using you in ministry, you're growing, be careful if you think you stand lest you fall. Only by God's grace. Jesus said, without me you can do nothing. Along with that, what is your attitude towards weak people? What about those lame 200 people that only could go about 130 miles in a week and couldn't make it the last 20 miles or something? Those guys that got left behind at the brook. Do we have people like that in the church? We must, because Paul says, encourage the faint-hearted and help the weak. There are weak people in the church, not necessarily physically weak, although some of those, but there are people in the church who have sometimes feeble faith. People who don't serve as much as other people do. People who don't have the same degree of gifting as other people do. People who struggle with depression, with fear, with doubt. People who can be kind of a burden, you know? Some people are kind of a burden. Not everybody in the church is really easy. Some people require a lot of care and help and don't give a lot back. What should our attitude be towards those people? May God deliver us from being the arrogant, like those sons of Belial who say, well, those people don't deserve anything. May God deliver us from being judgmental perfectionists who look down on others who aren't as good as we think we are. This applies in the family as well. Your wife's not perfect. Your husband's not perfect. Your kids aren't perfect. Your kids should be perfect. They have much better parents than you did. But we can be tempted to look down and impatient with people who aren't as strong as we think we are. If we realize that there is no place for pride, and those, like Mark said when he was introducing the service, we who deserve nothing but wrath, that we should be humble, not negative, fault-finding, expecting others to be perfect and looking down upon them because they're weaker than we are. That's the way the church operates. I love in 1 Corinthians 12 where Paul talks about the different parts of the body and you know how we all have different functions. And that in of itself is a good thing, is that just because you may be the person who prays and nobody sees you praying, you're praying on your own. You're praying for the missionaries. You're praying for the elders. You're praying for the work of the church. And you're faithful in that. And it's not a visible gift. Everybody's going, oh, thank you. But God may be using that more than the person who preaches. God may be using those who give and enable the missionaries to go forth and not visible and not recognized publicly in great ways. I love when Paul's talking about this, but in the latter part of the passage in verse 20, he says, there are many members, but one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, or the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, it is much truer that the members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. And those members of the body which we deem less honorable, on those we bestow more abundant honor. And our less presentable members become more presentable. He's saying those who are weak, even though they may not appear to be the most useful and functional people, are to be highly valued, highly honored, highly respected in the church, in the family. Another application is just generosity. So often we deal with people according to what they deserve, what we think they deserve, what we think is fairness. Well, it's fair. We fought, you didn't fight, you shouldn't get much. You can do this when you're at a restaurant and you're adding up the bill and you're thinking, well, he got a drink and I just drank water to save money, so why should I pay for half of his drink? We need to really calculate this carefully. And in much bigger issues in life as well. To be generous. God has so abundantly blessed us. We should be a generous, gracious people not demanding our rights and what we think is equal and fair, but to, as we have received much, to be giving and generous people to our brothers and sisters, to our family members. Now, the big picture of what God is doing here is that David is being elevated by God and Saul is being brought down. And David here in his leadership of Israel is being shown to be a type of the Messiah. We see here throughout the passage, David is a worthy leader, isn't he? What a contrast to Saul. Here's a man who's calm in a crisis. Here's a man who cares more what God thinks than what people think. That's so much of a downfall of so many human leaders, isn't it? They govern by polls. They govern by their popularity. Well, in verse 6, David's numbers are really low. He's down in the 20s in terms of his approval rating. Then in verse 20, he's up in the 90s in terms of his approval rating. But he's not living by their approval. He's seeking to please God and do what God wants him to do, regardless of what the people think of him. I shared last Sunday night, I was speaking with one of our former interns, who's now the pastor of a church overseas, and he was going through a very hard time. He is going through a very hard time. We prayed for him, and part of the hard time he's going through is he's got about a dozen sheep who bite. And it's hard to be a shepherd with sheep who bite. He's got people in that church who are against him, people in that church who, for no biblical reason, are trying to undermine him and are being political with him. And the encouragement I was giving him is, I think I brought in this passage, that David strengthened himself in the Lord. That your objective, first of all, you've got another 70 sheep who aren't biting, and you need to focus on feeding them. And you need to seek to please God and not worry about what these people think, and not to give up. To strengthen yourself in the Lord means you press on. You realize, yeah, people are fickle. But it's the Lord who will help you. You do His will. We follow Him. And that's what David did. He did according to what God said. He's generous in victory. And the title of the sermon is A King Who Gives. And David is a king who gives. In the end of the chapter, he has all this spoil. The people said, this is David's spoil. But he doesn't keep it all for himself. He's generous and he's giving to the people of Judah and to the men who didn't work. And this is such contrast. Remember back in chapter 8 when the people wanted a king? And what did Saul say about, what did Samuel say to the people about the king they had chosen? He will take. He's going to take your children to be his workers in his army. He's going to take your crops. He's going to take your animals. He's going to take, take, take. Well, here is a king who gives. And soon he will reign. Well, all of this I see is a beautiful picture of Christ. Jesus is a perfect leader for his people. Of course, he leads not to please the masses, but to please his Father. Those who should have followed him rejected him. Those who should have followed him sought to kill him, though he had no fault. But what's the most lovely thing to hear to me is the picture of David going forth and winning a victory for those who didn't fight. Because you and I are among the 200 who stayed behind and didn't really do anything. When Paul says in Romans 4, verse 5, I was looking in the wrong book of the Bible, that's why the verse I was expecting wasn't there. But to the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is credited as righteousness. Just as David also speaks of the blessing on the man to whom God credits righteousness apart from works. You see, for the men left behind, someone else went ahead of them and fought for them and then came back having won the victory, bringing back their wives, their children, their stuff. And they shared in the victory even though they didn't fight. Well, in our case, there weren't 400 people who went with Jesus to the cross. There weren't even 12 who went with him. He went alone. And he fought Satan and sin and death, and he conquered them for us. And he came back. He's been raised from the dead. He came as we're bringing gifts. He won the victory, and all we could do is praise our King and worship our King who won the victory for us we could not win for ourselves as our great representative. He has defeated the strong man. He has defeated the enemy. He has carried away the spoil. Actually, we are Jesus' spoil. We are the fruit of his victory. And in verses 19, it says, nothing was missing. when David captured everything and got it back. Well, Jesus, when he went to the cross, he lost none of those he came to save. In his death, he died for all those the Father gave him, and all the Father gave him by the work of the Spirit through the Word will be saved. He has rescued all. He will rescue all that he came to save. Jesus has done also like David, that David didn't just get back what his people had lost. He got back more, because remember, he took from the other places and, you know, from the Amalekites and got that. So the people were richer at the end than they were in the beginning. Jesus, in his victory for us, didn't just restore to us what Adam lost. The innocence. I don't want what Adam had, because I'd fall like Adam did. He gave us something better. He gave us a righteousness which cannot be taken away. A salvation which we cannot lose as we are preserved by His grace. A standing better than Adam have. And yes, He did ascend, giving us gifts. Then the passage that popped into my mind from this passage in Ephesians 4 says, to each one of us grace was given according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore, it says, when He ascended on high, He led captive a host of captives, and He gave gifts to men. And Christ, we are the captives that Christ has set free, and now we are restored to God. But He also, in His victory, in His ascension, has left gifts for His church, gifts of teachers and leaders and servers and helpers and His Spirit. And He's abundantly blessed us. Those who are associated with Him share in His blessing. He bestows them as He sees fit. I don't even have time to develop it because of time. But one parallel in the New Testament is the parable of the workers. Remember, some worked all day, some worked the last hour of the day. They all got paid fairly. Well, likewise with Jesus, with David paying those who did less and did more, because it's all of grace. He bestows as He sees fit. And then, finally, I want you to see here, to see yourself. Where do you fit into this? There are some who even come to church who really resemble the Amalekites. It's what the world is doing, actually. They're eating and drinking and partying, and they think they're having a good time. And they don't know that their doom is upon them. The Amalekites thought, oh yeah, Israel, David and his men, they're 100 miles away. And yet, their doom came upon them. The judgment of God came upon them and they died. And there are people in the world today, and there are probably people in this room today, where you live as if life's a party. You're enjoying the good things of God. God gives you food and drink and pleasure, and that's ultimately His stuff you're enjoying. It's like it was the Israelite stuff the Amalekites were enjoying. But one day judgment will come. It could come today. You could die. Christ could return tomorrow. And if you're unready, you will perish, like the Amalekites did under judgment from God. Instead, turn to Christ. Be like that Egyptian guy, man. He's starving, he's hungry, and he receives bread from the Anointed One. And his life physically is restored. Be like the 200 who did nothing themselves but were glad to receive the gifts of their king. God is merciful. Turn to Him. In faith, confessing your sin, look to the champion, Christ, who defeated sin and death on the cross. And He will save you. He will deliver you. He will give you life. That's what we're going to remember today as we celebrate the Lord's Supper. We eat bread, we drink the cup, rejoicing in the victory that Christ has won for us, which we have the privilege of participating. Those who waited while our champion fought participate in the spoils of war. Amen.